We made this.
Hello everyone and welcome to The Time Is Now, Soylent Green is People. Before we get into today's episode discussion, I need to bring in some guests. But first up is our guest Adam Chamberlain, Associate Publisher of the Fourth Horseman Press and co-editor of Back to Frank Black. Welcome back, Adam, to the podcast. How are you doing?
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me back. I'm doing very well, thank you.
I'm not too bad. It's a wonderful world we're living in at the moment. We're recording during the COVID-19 issue. So we're having a drastic uptick in podcast recordings, I think is the appropriate word. So it's all good.
But also very timely when we get to the second season. I think the finale is going to be an interesting one to discuss, I imagine.
It is. And that, folks, is, if you don't already know, one of the co-hosts of the 250, Darren Mooney. Darren, how are you doing?
I'm good.
You're under lock and key, I believe. You're in isolation at the moment.
Yes, I am, by choice, he says, hoping that he doesn't cough on the air. I'm based over in Ireland, so we've been kind of on lockdown for the past week, leading to the most disappointing St. Patrick's Day, I think, in the history of the nation state. But it's okay, because we have a president who has some lovely dogs, who came and told us everything was going to be okay.
For those international people, they literally closed the pubs the day before St. Patrick's Day, didn't they?
It did. National crisis here in Ireland. What's interesting is that, like, there's a real sort of sense of, you know, the Tommy Tiernan describes the three states of Irish legality. They are, you're grand, you're pushing it, and cop yourself on. Which is basically, if you get stopped by a guard, you'll get one of those three, you know, green, orange, or red lights. So we gave the pubs a bit of a watch yourself there, I think, last Thursday, when they were like, we need to be wary of large gatherings of hundreds of people in close proximity, because that will allow the spread of the virus. And then what happened is the following evening, somebody went into Temple Bar, which is Dublin's kind of tourist quarter, and basically filmed all of the pubs and bars that were open and the kind of insane level of proximity that was happening there. So we went straight from you're pushing it to cop yourselves on, and basically physically shut down the pubs, which is quite remarkable in the history of the Irish state. Not to draw on national stereotypes at all.
No. But it's not exactly the best, is it, really, when you're closing on the national day, is it? So we are going to be talking about season 2, episode 14, The Pest House. It was written by Glenn Morgan and James Wong. It was directed by Alan Coulter. And it was released on the 27th of February 1998. Alan Coulter, it's quite as a strange coincidence. He only directed one episode of the X-Files, and I think he directed three episodes of season two. He did this one, Beware of the Dog, and a future episode which we'll be following in Siren. So he's done three episodes of this season. I think he goes on later on, doesn't he, to do Sopranos and Sex and the City and Boardwalk Empire. So he goes on to do that. But before we get into the episode itself, Adam, have you had any good dreams lately?
Yes, I have. But maybe I won't share them. They're all mine. Yeah.
they're all yours. Okay, fantastic. We'll get into that in a bit. But before we go into the episode as a whole, we have the pleasure of looking at IMDb, as we always do. I know that Darren has an aversion to viewing them before coming on, which is great. So we'll play the usual game with Darren. Darren, what do you think our good folk on IMDb have scored this episode? And just from your opinion, what would you rate this out of 10? And also just your general thoughts before we move on to Adam.
Okay, in terms of IMDb ratings, so we're looking at, I'm going to guess, a slightly low number of voters, even relative to the second season. Obviously, Millennium typically has fewer voters than The X-Files has, which simply means it has a higher rating because you're more invested when you're voting in it, because the kind of people who are voting on IMDb for it tend to like it a lot more. That said, I think The Pest House is generally regarded as one of the lower, middle, possibly even higher bottom episodes of the season. So I'm going to go with a vote of somewhere around 7.6 on IMDb.
Your powers of IMDb scores of late have been absolutely incredible. 7.6.
Huh.
Yeah, you've done really well. 211 people. Okay, 211 people.
That's about right.
7.6. Yeah. You've got this down. You've got it down on the XCast. You're getting it down on the timers now. It's all going well. So what are your general thoughts first, Darren? Before we move into speaking to Adam about what he thinks of the episode and such, what would you personally rate out of 10? And what are your general thoughts? Just so you know that it works out around about 7th bottom in the run of the season. That's okay. Where it kind of falls in. So.
That's actually a bit higher than where I thought it would be, and probably a bit higher than where I would put it. Now, keep in mind that when I say that, I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10, which is actually a pretty good rating. And the thing about The Pest House is, and again, we'll probably talk more about this when we get into talk about the episode in a bit more depth, is that it's one of those episodes that I think is buoyed by the season around it. When you have a good season of television, and again, this is one of those things when you're talking about what makes a good season of television, how you discuss a good season of television, and whether it's like as simple as being, well, a good season of television is a season of television that just has lots of good episodes in it, or whether it's something kind of more consistent and more fundamental and more kind of baked through. And I tend to lean more towards the latter. I think the second season of Millennium is one of the best seasons of television ever produced, and I think part of the reason why that is because it has these consistent through lines. And these consistent through lines are so strong and so consistent and so clearly flowing from one episode to the next that if used well, they can actually buoy weaker episodes. So I think like The Pest House is an episode that has a number of problems with it, structurally speaking. I think if you were to like take this episode and just show it randomly to somebody outside the context of the season, they'd be like, yeah, it's an okay episode of television maybe, but there's a whole bunch of stuff that maybe doesn't mesh together, a whole bunch of ideas that are maybe a little bit underdeveloped in these 45 minutes. But I think that the beauty of the second season of Millennium is that when you put The Pest House in that context, all of its underdeveloped ideas have typically been explored elsewhere in the season, or are kind of like developing on ideas that have been touched on elsewhere in the season. And so if you're watching this in a run of the 20-odd episodes of the second season, it doesn't feel particularly weak because it's kind of buoyed by everything around it. So I actually like it a great deal, even if it wouldn't be one of my highlights of the season. And I think it's a testament to how good the second season is and why the second season is as good as it is. That's something like this, which would be a lackluster or mediocre episode in the first season or the third season, instead feels like it actually fits perfectly. It feels like there's a little jigsaw puzzle, shaped absence where this should go in the second season, which I think kind of gives it a bit of an advantage that it wouldn't otherwise have, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue it even goes back to some elements of season one as well, with some of the themes that we'll no doubt get into, and the reason why Millennium actually came into being from Chris Carter's view and his view on evil and things like that. I would probably go a 6.5. I would probably be a bit meaner to it. Probably in opposition to what you're saying, that it falls in between the Mikado and Owls and Roosters, which are two of my favourite episodes of the season. Yeah. It's one of those where I'm not particularly a big horror fan, as daft as that sounds being a Millennium fan. But as an all-out horror, it's not kind of my genre as such. So this one kind of harks more to that horror tropes in a lot of ways. And it doesn't really resonate with me as much as what it could do. But having said that, a 6.5 out of 10, that is low in my estimation of the episode. But over the course of the season, as you say, as it links in with everything, and as you mentioned about it being... it touched upon in another part of the season and potentially season one, I still think it's not a bad episode of television by any means. So Adam, what do you think? What are your general thoughts and rating on this?
I feel bad now because I'm going to rate it slightly lower than either of you. I would give this a 6 out of 10, and that's from having... So I watched this again last night. I've watched it many times, but I thought I'd watch it last night. I don't think it's aged particularly well in certain aspects, and in particular representations of mental illness and its viewpoints on that. And And to me, it often, so I get what you're saying in terms of some of the themes that it explores, but to me, it sometimes doesn't feel like an episode of Millennium, and it certainly doesn't feel like Frank Black as himself in an episode of Millennium. So, for those reasons, I'm going to score it a little low, as much as it pains me to do so.
Right, no, that's absolutely fine. I'm sure that we'll get into some of that, because I do have my thoughts on certain aspects of this, which I think are either stereotypical or don't really quite fit, and I'm sure we'll get into that. So shall we? I think we should maybe then delve into it. Then let's delve deeper into the nature of evil on this episode. Well, let's talk about the opening sequence. I mean, to me, something that you've just mentioned there, Adam, about it not feeling quite millennium-istic, this feels very much to me either like a horror kind of opening or an X-Files cold open. What did you make of this introduction to the episode and the idea of urban legends as it comes out of the cold open?
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember I enjoyed this a lot at the time on its own terms, but it felt very contrived to me, that opening of the teenage couple in the back of the car talking about this stuff, and then lo and behold, it plays out right in front of them. It just felt a little silly and contrived and not what you'd expect from Millennium. But so actually, I on my hard drive somewhere, I have the teaser, the Fox's trailer for this episode, and it's quite funny to watch it back as well, because it plays up those horror tropes, and it's got the voiceover saying, "Oh, you think you knew Millennium? You're wrong. You're dead wrong." And so setting this up to be something quite different. So perhaps that was intentional to entice viewers who are interested in this kind of material. I don't know, but yeah, it was entertaining. It drew me in, but yeah, it felt off in terms of the tone a little, I think.
Just touching on that, Darren, with the horror tropes and throughout the episode as well, but also this urban legend kind of myth thing that they've sprinkled through the episode. What did you make to that and this cold open?
Well, just two things. So on the horror opening, kind of on the horror kind of movie aspect of it, and again, it's very much a horror movie, even beyond the urban legend thing. There's a lot of slashing, a lot of cutting, a lot of shot of knives. There's lots of silhouettes and shadows and darkness, and it's very much structured in the style of a kind of a horror movie. And I mean, even in terms of the urban legend thing, it's worth noting that September that year, so what, 7 months later, after this was broadcast, you would have a movie literally called Urban Legends being released. And its opening sequence, its teaser, would be riffing on that sequence later on, where Dr. Stoller's driving in the car and there's a killer in the back seat, that famous urban legend there. What's interesting about this is that I think that you can probably contextualize the Pest House a bit more in terms of Glenn Morgan and James Wong's filmography, because they were two writers who were very, very interested in horror in particular, and kind of slasher movies in particular. It's worth noting that after they worked on Millennium, they had a big breakthrough in terms of the Final Destination films, particularly the first one that they worked on, where Final Destination, if you wanted to be cheeky and dismissive, I think the first one's great. I think the next couple have a number of great set pieces in them. But if you wanted to be really cheeky and dismissive of Final Destination, you could argue that it's a slasher movie where the villain is the Grim Reaper, where it's basically just a set of Rube Goldberg machines set up to torture teenagers, which is very similar to the slasher movie template. And again, you can kind of see that through there. Like, even after that, I think Glenn Morgan went on to work on one of the Black Christmas reboots, not the most recent one, which was Sophie Takei, I think, but he worked on a Black Christmas reboot, and Adam can correct me if I'm wrong, shortly after this as well, I believe. So there's a real sense of maybe this being kind of a Morgan and Wong kind of something that interests them and something that they want to do and something that kind of catches their attention. With regards to the urban legend thing, again, this is one of the points where the episode doesn't necessarily work particularly well for me. And it's not just the kind of like trashy gaudiness or contrivance that the kind of Adam mentions, although it is absolutely a part of it. It's more the fact that, like, look at how the episode's structured, and not to jump too far ahead, but like, the episode is nominally about a bunch of serial killers that are based on urban legends, right? That's what it looks like from the outset, and that all the kills in the episode are riffing on urban legends. I mean, you have the kind of the hook on the car hood, for example, is the opening one. You have kind of later on that sequence with the car is another one. The finger food, quite literally, is another one after that, for example. But you have kind of like this idea that these killers are being inspired by urban legends. And again, that's kind of interesting, and it's kind of, you know, you can see why that would interest Morgan and Wong, and why that would be something that, like, the second season Lenny would be interested in, because as you pointed out, this came directly after The Mikado, which is an episode that's very much about the anxiety of the internet age. And one of the anxieties of the internet age, anyone who was on the internet in the late 90s would know that these urban legends got a second life through sites like Snopes.com around the same time, 97, 98, 99. And that's probably where all this is coming from. And the idea of kind of like taking these very specific local stories and rendering them kind of global. And you could arguably, if you wanted to, and at a push, and maybe being very generous to the episode, argue that kind of this is a companion piece to something like, say, Morgan and Wong's Home, which is arguably, again, about this idea of something that is like a local story, a local horror story that's told by people who live in a local community that ends up going global and becoming bigger and kind of spreading out beyond where it originally began. But the problem for me with the urban legend aspect of the episode is that it makes absolutely no sense in terms of plot. Because it turns out, and again, not to jump ahead in terms of discussion, but it turns out that the modus operandi of the killings that happens in the episode, which just so happen to be urban legend themed killings, are not the MO of a single serial killer. They happen to be the MOs of three different serial killers who just so happen to be staying in the same psychiatric institution and who just so happen to have been victims of the same sin eater, who is then acting out those kind of serial, those urban legend type murders on people in the vicinity around the institution. And so instead of it feels like a contrivance. It's not one killer reenacting urban legends. It's three different killers enacting three different urban legends who happen to come together to be combined into one killer who reiterates those urban legends. And it doesn't really work narratively for me. It feels almost like two drafts of two separate scripts that were crammed together. Like, they had the urban legend script, they had the Sin Eater script, and they couldn't quite figure out how to get them to work kind of in kind of comparison to one another. And I think that's kind of my problem with the aspect of kind of doing the urban legend stuff. I think the urban legend stuff is almost a different episode than the Pest House ends up being, if that makes sense.
This is something that I actually had written down, actually, as one of my notes, is that do we even need that urban legend aspect of it in there? I mean, very early on, just going into the Woodcock thing, we are introduced to the MO of Woodcock, and quickly we're told that he's incapable of doing that. And then the following murder nicely fits in with what we learn of Bear just before the killing happens, that you see the blood, for example, that's pointed out to the audience before the attack happens. And then towards the end, we get Perdrew, where we think he's going to, well, pretty much most people would probably guess that that's not what's happening. We get into that aspect that the kind of, throughout the episode, they're trying to keep you on your toes with saying it's this, it's that, you expect it to be Bear, it's a whodunit kind of thing. But then you've also got the long game with Perdrew, and there's glances and looks that he does, that he's whispering to people, that you get the scene, which always, I mean, the same kind of scene happens in War of the Cofferages, where there's something crawling underneath the arm, and I can't do that. so you get all these aspects. You've got like a short con, which is thinking it's one particular person, and it's not. And they do that two or three times. And then you've got the longer con, which is Perdrew, where you see him almost, you're thinking he's orchestrating it. Do you think, Adam, do you think that worked? And with regards to the urban legends thing, do you think that they really, really needed that aspect in there, and they could have just done that a slightly different way? And what Darren says there with the Sin Eater and the urban legend.
Yeah, I agree with Darren. It does feel as though the two have been somewhat shoehorned together. But I wonder just in terms of the teaser itself, whether it's for the more casual viewer, perhaps that was a hook to get people into the episode.
Oh, I see what you did there.
I see what you're doing.
Yeah, I know. Sorry. I'm talking to you, Darren. I feel like I have to indulge the puns. I have to compete. So,
don't leave us dangling, eh?
Yeah. But perhaps that is a way into the episode for perhaps for folks who wouldn't normally be engaged by an episode of Millennium but have caught that teaser and will stick around. But narratively, I agree, it doesn't really quite hold together and it doesn't really need that element to the story.
Yeah. So what did you think too these aspects where they're trying to throw the audience off? Then do you think that was effective, and especially with Pedro being the longer con compared to the shorter ones where you literally see Bear see the blood with the arm, and then the following scene is basically you see the blood and you're led to believe that is him.
There's something about the initial setup that I quite like. It's almost sort of Holmesian or something with this sort of impossible crime. Hang on a second. We start to learn that the MO here is of somebody who couldn't possibly have been outside of the hospital at the time it was committed. And so there's something intriguing about it as a device, but it doesn't quite work for me. And really the fundamental point I come back to is I'm very uncomfortable, especially watching this in 2020 with just this representation. I understand these are people with particular mental illnesses who are deemed have to be kept away from society, but this whole mental illness equals serial killer kind of thread to it, it just sits very uneasily with me.
Yeah, what do you think, Darren? I mean, I was going to bring up the kind of the psychiatric hospital, and we'll do that in a second. But what did you think to the through line that they tried to put into this?
You mean in terms of the psychiatric hospital, or just sort of the
just in terms of the kind of the whodunit throwing you off the scent, having it's an organized crime, it's not an organized crime. There's different MOs happening. What you expect for the audience.
It's kind of funny that Adam mentions kind of the Holmesian kind of nature of the mystery, which is the mystery where the primary suspect couldn't possibly have done it, logistically speaking, and that being kind of a nice, again, a hook into the episode, as it were. But the fact that the solution to that is, oh, it's a sin eater, as if like that's a perfectly rational explanation that you can kind of set up or expect the audience to have intuited at some point along the way, means that it doesn't really work as a kind of a straight through line. I will say, though, I'm maybe not as cynical about the urban legend aspect of it as Adam is. I do think that, I think if you look at Morgan Wong's work and their kind of interests, I think that while that trailer that he mentioned, which is very much Millennium like you've never seen it before, smacks of kind of like Fox being like, oh dear God, we have to somehow trick people into watching the show, which is great, by the way, and you shouldn't have to trick people into watching it. But, while the trailer might have been that, I tend to at least credit Morgan and Wong with having a sense of doing this because they want to. I think that if you look at the work that they've done in the genre outside of it, and the fact that they do kind of have this affection for horror that runs throughout their filmography, I don't believe that it was a sense of let's trick viewers into watching this. I imagine that for Morgan and Wong, it's like we want to do an old-fashioned 80s kind of slasher movie. And again, Adam's entirely right. There's a lot of problematic stuff in here. There's a lot of stuff that is very, very uncomfortable to watch. And a lot of that stuff is down to the porting over of, horror cliches, and not just like kind of 80s horror movie cliches, although obviously they're particularly obvious in the kind of slasher movie boom of the late 70s going into the 80s, where it's like, if you need an excuse for somebody to stab something, just say they're psychiatrically, mentally ill. And that's all you need to do in order to justify this violence, even though, again, the vast majority of people with psychiatric illnesses are not violent in any way, shape, or form. And it creates a sort of a stigma that, kind of lingers to this day. But I do think that, I suspect a lot of what happens in the Pest House kind of comes from a place of affection and homage and wanting to do that sort of stuff. And I kind of, again, I think that stuff is problematic. And I think when we talk about it, there's a lot to unpack and discuss there. And I think that there is it's not even so much the portrayal of the patients that kind of sit with me ill. It's the way in which the episode approaches, say, Dr. Stoller, and the tone that it takes towards her in certain places that I think is particularly uncomfortable. But I do think that the episode is doing an homage to the style of horror that Morgan and Wong really like. And while it doesn't excuse it, it does kind of contextualize it, at least for me.
I love how every time I record with you, Darren, that I basically read my notes, and the next question that I'm about to say is exactly what you tell me. I'm like, right, where am I going to go now? Because one of my things was obviously the portrayal of this stigmata of psychiatric patients. And what Dr. Stoller says as well about the doctors being patients and the terminology that's used, that they're all wearing, you know, they can only decipher who they are from the keys. A lot of that is kind of narrative, I personally think. But Dr. Stoller's portrayal here, it's obviously Melinda McGraw. I mean, I had the pleasure of meeting her at X-Fest last year, so that was great to do that. But she does a perfectly good job in portraying the role. But my thing, that she's strongly minded, but in the wider context of it, what does this do for that characterization and almost a stereotypical kind of protective doctor who's defending, who's quite blinded to what is actually happening because she's so blinded by the fact that
she exists to be wrong, like is her primary function narratively. Like Stoller exists so she can be wrong. Sorry to jump on or just going to step.
No, that's exactly what I was going to. I just couldn't get the words out. The psychiatric thing, Adam, you've touched upon that. I mean, what did you think to that then, of Dr. Stoller's portrayal and character stereotypical thing and the actual psychiatric part of it?
She doesn't feel like a real character to me. She certainly doesn't fit in this hospital for how they set it up. So these are people who are deemed to be a danger to themselves, to society, that can never leave here and so on. And yet her sort of relaxed tone, as Darren said, she seems to exist to be wrong. I just don't believe her character. I think that's the problem. And no disrespect to Melinda McGraw, who is, of course, great as always. But that's one of my main problems with it. Even the whole hospital itself, I don't know, I don't believe it. I don't believe any of it. It doesn't seem at all, really. Even for the time for the 90s and so on, it's got this sort of dilapidated hospital and this whole relaxed idea of patients and doctors looking together, looking alike, other than the keys that the doctors carry. None of it fits to me. It feels like a construct for the type of story, as Darren has said, that perhaps Morgan and Mon were trying to tell, as opposed to something that feels real. And then when you put Frank Black and Peter Watts in the middle of it, that makes it feel even less real to me in some of the exchanges that they have when they're there.
Yeah, I mean, you've come on to Frank and Peter there. So Adam, you're starting to do this now as well.
Sorry.
It's okay. Maybe you're taking stuff from my mind. But yeah, they particularly seem out of character. Well, Peter not so much, but Frank seems particularly out of character in this. I'm not too bothered in a lot of episodes where the characters are behind us on knowing what's happening. But Frank does seem particularly lackadaisical in this episode, in things like the petrol station.
Oh, I was going to come to that. I think I took a whole point for that scene. That is not Frank.
So it just seems that they seem to be so far behind the actual show itself and the story it's telling, which again, as I say, I know it's a perfectly good argument to say that they shouldn't be like that. But sometimes, you know, the story can be the story and they can just be passengers on the way. But this just felt just kind of wrong. I don't know if you picked up on that, Darren, and how you would perceive the characterization in Frank in this one.
Yeah, I mean, well, just to go back to Dr. Stoller very, very briefly, and again, it's something that the second season Millennium hits on a little bit. It's kind of like a minor recurring beef because it's the sequence where she says, "We feel uniforms and lab coats just serve to stigmatize the patients." That feels very much like kind of like, you know, a snide mocking of kind of the idea of kind of inverted commas left wing, you know, sort of like healing and kind of psychiatric treatment for dangerous criminals. But it also reminds me a bit of, you know, something from Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense, where you have Self-Osophist saying the term patient has unhealthy associations. And it kind of feels like it's kind of mocking that attempt at kind of being conscientious, or that attempt at kind of like, you know, sort of portraying her as an idealist who is completely out of step and doesn't understand how evil these people are, how broken these people are, and how silly she is for thinking that she can help them in the first place. And it is, in terms of the characterization of kind of Frank and Peter, and again, I'm probably a bit more forgiving of it than you guys are. It is very much like we want to make a slasher movie. There's a sequence where, you know, Frank's cell phone...
I don't want a slasher movie. I don't want a slasher movie.
I, I, like, again, slasher movies are generally terrible because they're generally lazily written. And again, you can apply that to this episode as well. We pointed out this episode isn't the best structured episode of Millennium ever. But I think you could do slasher movies well. I think the original Halloween, I think that maybe Nightmare on Elm Street, I think Scream, they're all good slasher movies. I don't think this is a good slasher movie. I think this is a bargain basement slasher movie, kind of with a little bit of millenniumistic stuff injected into it. I think I'd perhaps credit it for having a bit more millenniumistic stuff than you guys do. But in terms of the characterization of Frank and kind of Peter, again, you're right that it feels like it's very secondary. It's like the Stoller kind of stuff where they feel more like functions than characters. Like, so you have sequences where Frank's cell phone battery dies, which is, again, feels like one of those late 90s things where people who are writing horror movies are trying to figure out how to write the same horror movies they were writing in the 1970s, but with technology that existed in the 90s. And you kind of get this rationalization in the episode itself. I mean, I think at one point Frank says, everything old is new again, which feels like it's kind of an attempt to justify this kind of throwback stuff, this sort of like attempt to make, you know, a 1970s horror movie in the context of like a 1997-98 season of kind of Millennium. And it just... It doesn't work, but I'm kind of almost forgiving of it. I think that... Yeah, sorry, go for it there.
Sorry, but just to go back to the petrol station bit, and I know we're jumping forward in the episode, but that whole sequence, that scene, so where Frank there sort of rescues Dr. Swartz, or he turns up after the gas station or petrol station attendant has taken her out of the car and so on, and then rushes her away... and leaves, knowing that there was this would-be killer on the scene seconds before, leaves the poor petrol station attendant alone to certain death. That just makes Frank look reckless and stupid to me in a way that just isn't Frank. And it's as though that's done just so you can have the scene of the petrol station attendant being brutally murdered or behind a door or whatever. But yeah. It's for the purpose of exactly the kind of storytelling that you're referencing. But it undermines Frank's character and it makes him look stupid and weak. And that's what I don't like about it.
That's entirely fair. And I definitely sort of see that. And there is a kind of a real sense throughout of this not being a story that has any characterization of Frank. I don't think there's anything in here that speaks to what Frank's doing or where Frank is. And this is kind of rare in the second season of Millennium, where like throughout the season, even in episodes that are nominally disconnected from, you know, Frank's situation or Frank's relationship to the group, you normally get some small reference somewhere to where Frank's head is at. Here instead, you just seem to have Frank showing up to be the generic horror movie protagonist, but not even that, the generic witness to a horror movie plot, because he doesn't actually do that much. And I mean, even at the end of the episode, when he kind of, and again, sorry to jump all over the place here again, Kurt, but even at the end of the episode where Frank delivers the kind of big important "this is what the episode's about" speech, he kind of just ends it with a shrug. It's like, well that's just what I think. You know, who really knows in this crazy upside down world in which we live? And again, I can see that, like, I don't think it's great. I'm not speaking in defense of it. I think I may be a bit more forgiving of it than you guys are, but it absolutely is a problem with the episode.
This episode to me feels I feel a couple of things with this one. That it feels like it could be a season two episode of The X-Files. It could easily fit in with I would say, what am I thinking? Irresistible.
There's even a bit of Excelsior Day in here. And I
Excelsior
mean, for
Day
or worse,
was the one like... I was riding up to, yeah. So which
it is
which
much better than
end.
Excelsior Day, I would contend, despite my problems with it.
I think we can all agree on that, I think. Unless Adam's got absolutely loves Excelsior Day, then...
No, I'm with you, yeah.
But it does feel like a season two episode. It almost, and this is what I was saying about some in some elements, especially with some of the flashing scenes right at the very end where... we've got Stoller seeing the flashes of all of the evil within it. And I will talk about that shortly as flashbacks to what Irresistible happened with Scully and that aspect. But there's also the almost like a lamentation kind of feel to it as well. So there's this definite darkness and evil linking in with, like, season two of X-Files was very dark. And, you know, obviously Millennium was built out from season two and season three. Do you feel that? Do you feel it could fit into season two of The X-Files? And you know, Peter and Frank in some ways could easily just be replaced with Mulder and Scully in some ways. And I think that's what Adam's, one of Adam's points is that they feel like they've just been dropped into the story. It's a story that Morgan and Wong wanted to say, but it doesn't really fit the mold of what they were trying to do at that point.
I mean, I think that there's a pretty strong connection in terms of, say, the second season of kind of Millennium and the X-Files that it came from. I mean, right down to Morgan and Wong initially wanting to bring the Peacocks back and doing kind of a sequel to Home, but we're told, no, those people will never appear on television ever again by Fox broadcast standards and practices. But I mean, even things like, say, the two-parter Owls and Roosters kind of has a very X-Files-y kind of feel to it. It's very Millenniumistic. I love and hate that I use that as an adjective, but it's very much in keeping with the spirit of Millennium. Owls and Roosters is much more than Pest House, but you can see it being repurposed as an X-Files episode. The same thing with, say, the Mikado as well. You could easily imagine the Mikado almost playing out as an X-Files episode as well, where you just go back to, you know, Mulder's time working in the behavioral profile kind of unit, behavioral sciences unit or stuff like that. I do think that, yeah, this is a particularly generic one. I think the difference between those is that I think, you know, Owls and Roosters or the Mikado, if they'd appeared in the second season of the X-Files, would have signaled a bold new direction for the show and would be kind of touchstones going forward. I think the problem with the Pest House is that if it were a second season episode of the X-Files, it would be one that everybody has forgotten about. And to be honest, it kind of is, even in this context of this season that we're here now. I don't think this is the worst episode of the second season. I mean, I gave it a 7 out of 10, but I think it's much better than, say, Sense and Antisense, which is just a mess from beginning to end. I think it works a lot better as an episode of television than Siren does, even though Siren has a much stronger idea of what it's doing and what it's about, but it suffers from that same problem where it seems like two scripts mashed together and doesn't execute either of them particularly well. But I still think that what it's trying to do is interesting. And I think that, you know, not to jump too far ahead in the conversation, I think that what it does with the notion of evil is interesting, particularly in the context of Millennium. And I think it kind of manages to wed those two, well, not elegantly or efficiently. And in fact, its difficulty wedding them is a big problem with the episode, but still does it in a way that kind of means I don't hate it. This is the weakest defense anybody's ever made of anything ever. This is why I don't hate this episode. yeah. But no, I kind of, like, I can see the problems with it and I acknowledge they're there. But I think that there's interesting stuff happening there regardless.
It's in one of the best seasons of television ever, as far as I'm concerned. So it's not, I'm not by any means saying it's the worst episode of TV that I've ever seen, or even anywhere near to some of the dross that you do see in a lot of TV. But we're obviously rating this with a high bar of season two as a whole, and we will get into the evil aspects. That'll be the next thing we get into. But I just wanted to touch base with Adam on this kind of on what we've just been saying over the last few minutes. What do you think, Adam, to where this fits and where you think it lies with everything else?
Yeah, I just have to say too, I could never hate any episode of Millennium. So I'm with you on that. I'm not saying it's terrible or whatever. I'd much rather watch a mediocre episode of Millennium than virtually anything else. So, so I can see how, yes, this could be repurposed as an episode of the X-Files. I think you'd have the same problems in terms of making Mulder and or Scully look stupid if you weren't careful. So not to jump into the conversation about evil either, I think it has some interesting things to say on that score as well. But you could almost skip this episode in the second season and not really miss anything in terms of the larger storytelling. It just feel almost as close as Millennium gets to a filler episode.
The cast is quite an interesting choice. We've got Michael Massey, who doesn't do too much, but is in there at the end. We've got the gentleman playing, I can't remember his name now, but who plays Edward. We've got Melinda McGraw, and we've also got the guy from Roswell as well, who played Kevin at the very beginning, who was only appears for seconds. But so the actual cast itself, they've got quite a good selection of cast members, really, don't they? And what did you make to Michael Massey's character, Perdue, just before we talk in thematically about Nature of Evil.
The cast is great. It's one of those great sort of retroactive kind of wonderful casts where Louis Ferreira, I think, is the person that you're trying to name there,
yes,
who plays Edward.
That's him, yeah.
He was worked early in his career under the stage name Justice Lewis. In fact, I think he's actually credited here as Justin Lewis. And it's also got Michael Massey, who is, you know, a figure who is notorious, or not sort of notorious, that's not fair, but who is known cult circles for The Crow, where he was the actor who pulled the trigger on the gun that led to the death of Brandon Lee. And not his responsibility, to be absolutely clear, in any way, shape or form, but he was the actor who was working on the scene with him when that happened. And obviously Melinda McGraw, who is very well known for The X-Files, for playing the role of Scully's sister, but Melissa Scully, but also popped up in quite a few, I think, Morgan and Wong works as well. She's kind of worked with them a great deal along the way. And I think that the cast is kind of, I think it's actually, to be fair, probably overstacked in terms of cast for what it's doing. I think that you don't really get too many of those actors used to the best of their ability. I think Massey, in particular, is an incredible screen presence. I know him best from, say, the first season of 24. Where he plays the Ira Graves, who is the hitman for hire, who's basically organized the conspiracy to murder the presidential candidate Palmer over the first 13 episodes. And
it's just to jump in there, sorry, but I always remember, because on the first season on the DVDs, when you used to put the DVD in, it used to go, "I'm watching you."
Yeah.
And on all the episodes, if you left the title screen.
Yeah, no, Massey has this incredible screen presence and can be used very well. And I mean, in fact, actually, to be honest, he has a really tiny role in the movie Seven, which would have been released around the same time as this. And it's a tiny role. He plays a guy who operates a peep show booth. But he's incredibly memorable in that sequence. And you recognize him from that sequence. And so here, asking him to play a generic kind of serial killer feels almost like a waste of talent. I think the episode does something interesting with Perdue that we'll talk about when we get into The Nature of Evil. And I think that maybe casting Massey in that role, an actor who has that kind of natural presence and kind of ability to make you feel unsettled, is good casting, even if it doesn't use him to the best visibility. Justin Lewis is very young in this and kind of seems like he's kind of lost a little bit. And again, I don't think that's him as an actor. I think that's the way that Edward's defined, because you have, again, this is a kind of a sequence where, or an episode where you're trying to distract, it's a shell game, you're trying to distract the audience from the obvious conclusion, which is odd given how heavily foreshadowed it is. I mean, it's quite obvious that Edward is behind what's happening from the moment that he sits down in that group therapy session with Frank watching him. It's very obvious who the person responsible is, even if you're not sure of the mechanics of it. But again, Lewis kind of plays Edward as this weird blank slate, because he has to conceal, or he's trying to conceal, the nature of Edward until you get to the reveal at the end. Because the episode is structured, as you pointed out, to make you think that it could be Perdue up until the last possible minute, even though anyone who has ever seen a story like this before knows that it's not going to be Perdue. And again, as we mentioned with Stoller, like, McGraw's great. Stoller is not a good role. She's primarily a plot obstacle. She exists to put these hindrances in the way of Frank and, you know, in the way of Peter, in order to stop them from figuring out the plot ahead of time. And she's also designed to be the victim repeatedly. And the episode takes a great deal of pleasure in victimizing her, which is maybe not a great look when she's the only woman in the cast, in that it's her who finds the fingernail in her food, for example, while she's lecturing Frank about how important it is to respect patients and their rights. And then later on, she's almost murdered by somebody in her back seat and has to be saved by Frank because, you know, obviously she's far too gentle when it comes to treating these serial killers, and she won't listen to sense. And there's a real kind of malice to it that kind of undermines, you know, the point of casting somebody like Melinda McGraw in that role. So I think the cast is good. I just don't think they're used as well as they might be.
Yeah, and I think we've had precedence of this. I mean, Adam and I, we covered Monster, didn't we? And it was Robert Wisden and Chris Owens were in that episode. Obviously, Kristen Cloak as well. So it's not without precedent that they've brought in people, 10, 13 people, and people that they really like into an episode and potentially underused. And what did you make to the casting of these, madam?
Yeah, I agree with Darren that Melinda McGraw makes the sort of best of what she's given, and it's great to see her again. But certainly Michael Massey's the standout for me. And it's funny you mentioned 24. I don't think I've seen that season since it first aired, but I do still remember him in that season, which says something. But I think he kind of elevates this episode a bit. I think his performance as Purdue here, as you say, you don't buy that he's going to turn out to be the killer, but there's something more going on with his character, and that you get some of that complexity and nuance from how he portrays Purdue, and I think that elevates the whole episode for me. I think
one thing I noted was that Frank's Visions, and Frank's Visions is obviously a big debate on what it is and how it is and why it is, but in this particular episode I got a fair way into it, and I made a note saying there's no Frank's Visions here, there's nothing, it's really, you know, almost like you could potentially throw these in during the actual murder scenes, and Frank could be thrown a loop a little bit with it, but they don't do that. They hold back, and I know Morgan Wong wanted to hold that back, and they leave it until we do get to the Edward scene in the sort of surrounding group therapy session. So I think it's actually a good use. I think personally, I thought that was quite good, because I was waiting for the visions to appear. I haven't seen this episode for quite a while. And it did hit quite well. And I thought that was really well done. I did like, the way that Melinda McGraw played that she wasn't happy with him being there, and she's like, I know you'll be here, know that they don't, but I know you'll be here. I thought that was really good. But let's talk about that. I've been skirting around the issue of this, but let's talk about evil then. Let's look at what is physically happening, what is actually manifestation of this evil that's happening within this psychiatric hospital. Adam, what did you make of this the way that they're saying that the dreams are being taken away from him, that their MOs are being taken off him, and that Edward is there trying to do good by removing this element to them, and even like saying it removes them, their very soul of who they are. There's an element to that as well. What did you make to all that?
It is interesting in terms of its sort of statement on evil, and I know we talk a bit about this whole, you know, contagion of evil versus whether it's something that's sort of inherent in us and so on. What I think is most interesting about it is perhaps a less obvious route, but it's the notion of treating these people and actually, can you rehabilitate somebody in this sort of scenario? So more the sort of allegorical aspect of it, and actually, is there an impact upon people who are immersed in this, who are actually dealing with patients who are this severely ill, that actually it can break them? And there is that scene where Edward describes what happened to, is it Rachel, the nurse that was there, who had been attacked, been raped in front of them, and so on, and how horrendous that was. And I almost got a sense that that had broken him, and actually perhaps that led him down this path. And that's less the more sort of obvious or supernatural sin eater type approach. But to me, that was the most interesting reading of it, was actually this is someone who'd been broken by his experience of being with these people day in, day out, having seen a friend and colleague endure that at the hands of one of these people, and it had just broken him. So that, to me, is not the sort of direct or straightforward reading of what we see, but to me is the most interesting way of looking at Edward's character.
I mean, the one thing that I would take out slightly differently is the question, I think that one of the questions that they're asking is that can you rehabilitate someone, take away the very, what their renowned or very nature of what they are, is it inherently built into them, is it something that's been, you know, that's grown out of something, and if you take that away, are they still the same person personally? But Darren, I know that you'll probably have some interesting thoughts on this, so what did you make to this aspect that they're doing here?
Yeah I find myself kind of, it's an awkward one, because I, if you think about it too literally, it ends up going in some very uncomfortable directions. Like, but again, we talked about this earlier, the portrayal of kind of mental illness and kind of psychiatric treatment. we talked about this earlier, the kind of the portrayal of psychiatric and kind of, you know, mental illness, kind of mental health treatment in the episode, and the way in which it seems kind of like snide towards that, and kind of very dismissive of it. And I think that, like, if you were to apply that very literally to the episode's conception of evil, to this idea of, you know, of Edward taking the sins onto himself and literally stripping them out of people like Bear or Purdue or Woodcock, that you run into this kind of unfortunate and uncomfortable, again, another one of those cliches that you have about psychiatric treatment, which is the idea that, you know, this treatment fundamentally changes or kills or alters somebody. And it's something that you don't see. It's not necessarily something you always see in terms of discussions of rehabilitation. You see it in terms of, say, antidepressant medication, stuff like that. There's a lot of kind of like paranoid thought out there and a kind of a lot of anxiety around it. Ironically enough, given, you know, the subjects that were mocked earlier in Doomsday Defense, the self-osophists, but a certain amount of kind of arguments you see against psychiatry that suggest that doing psychiatry fundamentally changes a person or kills them or numbs them, which is very uncomfortable. It kind of puts a stigma around it, and it's something that I'm wary of when it comes to portrayals of discussions of that. So I'm kind of, that's perhaps why I don't lean towards reading the Pest House kind of too literally in that sense. Although I do think Adam is entirely right, though, about the idea of like being in contact with evil and being corrupted by, not corrupted by it, but being affected by it and being numbed by it. Because I think this is kind of the core of what I think the difference is between how Morgan and Wong see evil and how Carter sees evil, and the first and second season of Millennium as a result. Carter tends to see evil as something that gets into you from outside you and changes you. Think of it as, say, the black oil, or think of it as Mulder, you know, profiling serial killers and coming to learn to think like them. Or even just think of, you mentioned Irresistible, but the way in which, you know, Donnie Faster is portrayed as something demonic throughout his appearances in The X-Files rather than something human. And in contrast, Morgan and Wong offer a much more human idea of evil. But also, and again, this is something that Adam kind of mentioned when he talked about like looking at the second season of Millennium as a whole and putting the Pest House in context. The Pest House to me has always felt like a companion piece to A Room with No View, which is another episode later in the season, and its view of what evil actually is. And it's an evil that isn't sensationalist and isn't absurd, which sounds ridiculous in an episode that we talked about, which opens with teenagers getting massacred and dangling and scraping off the roof of a car. So it seems strange to say the real evil is banality, or, you know, sort of like, you know, mundaneity. But there is this sense in the way that Morgan and Wong kind of write, and in episodes like The Pest House and in episodes like A Room with No View, that what evil actually is stripping a person's essence out of themselves. It's an annihilation of an individual. Purdue describes it as his soul. And again, this is a really interesting kind of ethical debate, which is that the question of, if you could hypothetically do that, if you could strip out everything that makes a person a person, it's a Clockwork Orange basically argument. It's the question of, like, if you can annihilate a person, and in doing so, remove their evil from the world, are you justified in doing that? And a sense in which, tying into the larger themes of the second season, which are, the second season's all about this idea of apocalypse and about the end of the world. And the end of the world is seen through multiple prisms. It's, you know, the destruction of the tribe in A Single Blade of Grass, for example. It's the breakup of the Black family over the course of the series. You know, it's the potential loss of Frank's father as he sees in the midnight of the century. But the idea that the world is constantly ending for everybody, but in different ways. And in The Pest House and A Room with No View, you have the sense of the apocalypse being something that is incredibly intimate. That discussion that Edward has of Rachel and watching the light die in her eyes, which is ironically mirrored in what Purdue describes when he says, you know, I've had my soul torn out of me. I've had who I am taken away from me. It's literally been the end of his world. And a question of, is that itself a greater evil? Is destroying a person's essence, even the essence of somebody who is monstrous, who has hurt people, who has killed people, is destroying that essence a greater evil than, you know, what we would normally classify as evil, what we see in media as evil, what slasher movies kind of contextualize as evil? And it's an interesting question. It kind of exists almost in opposition to kind of like, you know, the tendency in, and again, I really like the first season of Millennium, but the first season of Millennium's tendency on occasion to veer towards the idea of evil as the most sensationalist, over-the-top kind of notion of itself. And I'm thinking particularly of, say, Loin Like a Hunting Flame, for example. And there is, like, again, you could argue that there's a tendency in Morgan and Wong's work to see this with, say, The Thin White Line earlier in the first season as well, which has a similar sort of idea of the end of the world being a much smaller thing, a much more intimate thing.
It's a really interesting idea, actually. So it just got me thinking, talking about Room with No View. So I'm going to mangle a quote that I put in Back to Frank Black when I was writing about this stuff. There's a book by an author called M. Scott Peck called People of the Lie, where he talks about this stuff, and he characterizes evil as being anything that's in opposition to life. And that doesn't necessarily just mean sort of corporeal murder, but it can be anything that takes away the essential attributes of someone's life, such as their sentience and their autonomy and their own awareness and growth and these kind of things that you see in Room with No View. And I think it's astute to apply it here as well in terms of what Edward is doing. It's very interesting.
I should be absolutely clear. A Room with No View is a much, much better episode. A Room with No View is one of the best episodes of the season. So when I suggest an equivalence between the two, it's not necessarily in terms of quality, but I do think it suggests a kind of a preoccupation, a kind of running through the season. An idea that, yeah, that the apocalypse isn't just, you know, the unleashing of a deadly virus, to pick a completely random, arbitrary example that in no way is drawn from the real world or the end of the season coming up. But it can just as easily be the light dying in somebody's eyes. I think that's an important theme in the season. And that's pretty much, like, that's what gets the Pest House 7 out of 10, if we're being entirely honest. It kind of bumps it up a full 3 or 4 points for me. It's the idea of kind of, like, it existing in that context of a broader discussion the second season of what the end of the world actually means, and offering an answer that, you know, will be better refined later on, I think.
But that whole notion of evil as contagion and so on, not to talk too much about contagion, yeah. I'll be crass about it, but it's baked in even to the title, right? So the pest house, yeah. As the kids call it, so a pest house is somewhere where people were quarantined because they had contagious disease. So it is, that idea is very much baked in here as well, and I would argue into the way the group gets developed through season two as well. There's an infection to the group as well.
But. Yeah, and Edward taking the sins onto himself. Was it about Frank Black's and what I describe as the law of conservation of evil, which is basically that evil is never created or destroyed. It just changes form. And so what happens is when you try and fold it in, it ends up kind of changing you as a result, which is, I do think that even though it is contagion, and even though that is a metaphor that, say, Carter uses when it comes to portraying the spread of evil, I'm thinking in particular of that Empedocles in the 8th season, The X-Files, where you literally have evil, like, as a ghost that kind of walks into and possesses somebody. I think there's something slightly different even in this idea of evil as contagion, because there's a sense in which it has to be consensual. No, well, it's not, it doesn't have to be consensual for the victim, but it has to be drawn out. It has to be kind of sucked in. It has to be kind of consumed. It has to be eaten, as it were, rather than something that kind of gets into you and changes you, if that makes sense. In that, like, Edward makes the choice to take this into himself and to become this thing, even though he's incapable of managing it or incapable of kind of dealing with it. He's the one who acts in this way. It's not like the evil kind of randomly picked him because he was empathic. It's not like he's Will Graham. It's not even arguably... I suppose you could argue whether there's a difference between him and Frank Black, you know, the idea
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to say. I mean, do you think that they were trying to... Because they do... Frank Black does say it towards the end, doesn't he? They're kind of trying to mirror that ideal that Frank is that type of character, that he's taken on this evil. And will it consume him, or will he defeat it?
Yeah, and it's again, it's a very broad... The episode doesn't really get any points for developing that. It's the old cliche. And again, it's kind of interesting that you can trace this back, ironically enough, to the fact that one of the inspirations for Frank Black was at Douglas. I'm trying to think... Now, Adam will probably correct me if I'm wrong. You know, had an attack of a disease while he was in... Was it Atlanta? He literally just got sick and almost died while tracing a serial killer. And it had a rational explanation. He literally got sick. He caught an illness. But from that, you extrapolate out to, with Thomas Harris and Will Graham, the idea that, you know, profiling takes such a toll on a person's soul, their very essence, that they themselves are kind of corrupted and broken by it. And you have, obviously, with Will Graham having the breakdown before, you know, the events of Red Dragon, but even in the context of Millennium, with Frank Black himself having had a breakdown before the events of the series, and sort of while he was in the FBI and stuff like that. And I don't think The Pest House develops that theme as well as it might, but I do think it's there. And I think that there maybe is something in the difference in the way that the second season approaches the character of Frank Black as opposed to the first season. I think the second season is a lot more willing to acknowledge that Frank is changed by what he does. I think the first season teases it repeatedly, and it suggests that he can't take this stuff home with him and lock it in the basement as much as he might want to. But there's a sense of, even then, it's kind of more like he's got a lid on a toxic waste dump, as opposed to it's fundamentally altering who he is. There's a sense of, like, in the first season, of him hiding the Polaroids and therefore inviting the Polaroid stalker to come into the house. Whereas in the second season, it's more like Frank has engaged with this stuff and he himself has changed. He's become angrier. He's become a lot more standoffish. And I mean, I don't think of this episode, I think this episode is just, as Adam pointed out, bad characterization of Frank, but he has possibly become a bit more closed off to other people than he was in the first season. And I think that you can maybe apply a bit of that, as Kurt was suggesting, to the characterization of Edward and Frank. The idea that maybe Frank and as Adam pointed out, the Millennium Group itself are changed by contact with evil, but by kind of folding it into themselves. There's a sense as the second season goes on that the Millennium Group has kind of, it's almost like a hubristic thing where they've assumed a role and that role has kind of corrupted them, as opposed to acting entirely virtuously, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I mean, the thing about where this episode's placed as well, I mean, we had the Mikado before and we're moving into Owls and Roosters next, and that's going to be the big change. This episode almost feels like it's almost in a holding pattern. It is a filler, and it's not a filler, but it's still, as you say, the themes are still within there, that it's enough to discuss it, but it isn't going to drive anything forward by any means, especially the imagination. No. It still does feel like, I think you've hit the nail on the head with this slasher analogy, that they're wanting to do a slasher movie in the context of Millennium, and I just don't feel that it works as well as they would have hoped to, and you know, there might be production values behind that as well. So, but yeah, I mean, I think that unless you can think of anything else, the one thing I did want to bring up is at the very beginning is when, and it's just a small thing, but this has happened a few times over the course of the season where the group believes that this won't be an isolated incident. I go back to what Adam and I spoke about in Monster, where they say, go there, Frank. You know, you need to, there's something more to this. And it still gives you that ominous feeling of what do the Millennium Group know? And how are they aware of this? There's that issue. Now, you could read that simply as, you know, I don't think this will be an isolated incident because we were the Academy Group as well, that, you know, there must be something more to this. But the group is about to change next episode. So up until this point, what do you both think about where the Millennium Group has fitted in with season two? We'll start with Adam. With regards to kind of what they're saying here, they're obviously well in the background in this episode, but this is the final episode before we get into the back end of the season, really.
Yeah, I'm trying not to jump ahead when I think about this, because I obviously know what's to come. I'm trying not to think too far ahead. But yeah, as you say, it is more this sort of ominous and leading to something, and just sort of hints and so on to guide Frank along the way, isn't it? At this point, without really taking the bold leaps that we're about to get to. But I do think, just in general, with the group, and going back to this whole sort of evil as contagion thing, it is this, as Darren just touched upon, this idea of these groups that are specialized, that can become narcissistic, and you get a slightly getting a sense of that in terms of their sort of how they feel superior and so on. But that's, again, that's more, I'm talking about more what's to come, whereas it's, yeah, it's still all sort of hints and allusions at this stage. But as you say, it is, you do get a sense of the fact they keep referencing that it's building to something.
And again, this is probably one of those things where I'm giving this episode a great deal of credit because of the season it's a part of, rather than anything that is unique to this episode itself. But one of the things I actually really like about the second season of Millennium is because it has that thematic consistency I mentioned. So things around the idea of it, almost every episode in some way, shape or form being built around the end of the world or what the end of the world means for somebody, means that you can get away with stuff like that. You can get away with stuff like, you know, that cryptic hint, which is pretty much the one line in the episode that kind of like ties the pest house to anything happening in the rest of the season in terms of plot, where you can kind of say, you can kind of get away with Peter saying, yeah, well, the group thinks this could get pretty hairy, because there's a sense in which everything is getting pretty hairy in this season. And it's not necessarily that, you know, well, this is just a cheap way to kind of make it seem like this is important, because, I mean, it is a throwaway line. You could honestly miss it if you weren't paying that much attention. It's more in a sense of, well, it kind of builds into that sense of paranoia and mounting dread. As Adam mentioned, like, and as you mentioned, we don't have a specific sense of what the group is doing and how, you know, what exactly the group's planning and where they are. But you have had consistently throughout the season, particularly in, say, episodes like Luminary, where, you know, Frank has his big induction meeting into the group. But even that sequence where they storm in when they arrive at the beginning and the end, where they just sort of march in, which is one of those great, we're now in widescreen shots. Where the group just kind of marches in, like, no, we're in charge of this situation. But even things like, if you want to pick, say, the Mikado, the last episode, where it's revealed that the group actually has all of this technology just kind of hanging around. And it's just sort of like, you know, there's a sense of them having more resources and being more aware of things than, you know, Frank would expect a group of FBI agents to be. That kind of creates a sense of atmosphere that carries the episode and kind of fits with the rest of the season, rather than being anything that fits in terms of like plot or in terms of overarching kind of like, well, this is where the season's going. I think Adam said you could skip this episode and you would miss nothing in terms of plot. And being honest, because A Room with No View is later in the season, you could probably skip this episode and miss nothing in terms of theme either. But I do think that having them both is kind of good.
Yeah. Oh, you're right, that, of course, Luminary is as moving things forward for the whole, what we understand of the group. And, of course, you've had the Hand of Saint Sebastian as well, where you certainly get a hint of this being something other than what we thought it was prior in season one, for sure.
Well, I think that draws the episode to a close, really, unless there's anything you can think of or go through that you would like to bring up at this point. That's all I've got, anyway.
One shout out on something to be positive, because I do want to say other things about
it. We feel pretty. Maybe it's just the environment we're living in at the moment.
You know, yeah, maybe that's.
We're all stuck in our houses.
But I do. I particularly enjoyed Mark Snow's score in this episode. I always do. But I think in terms of the horror tropes that Darren's talked about, I think Mark Snow was clearly on point with that as well, and certainly plays to that with some of his some of the cues throughout this episode. So that's a plus for me as well. I wanted to call out.
And I do. I also like the actual setting as well. I know that, you know, we described it as kind of like a very gothic hospital, despite having this very new age sensibility. But I do like those shots that Coulter gives us with the kind of the grid windows, you know, which kind of do that nice, well, are these characters kind of segmented and separated and broken from themselves? The use of silhouette, the use of lighting. Again, that shot where, you know, they're wrestling on the ground with the knife dangling in the air as well, which is, again, it's a very kind of 70s slasher movie shot where you get the character on top raising the knife. You get the insert shot of the knife gleaming, and then you get the wide shot of the knife being plunged in. But it you know, I... Those sequences kind of work reasonably well for a reason, and it's good to see. I'm going to be honest, I'm going to say I enjoyed seeing Millennium kind of do that. I kind of liked that there was a sense of, well, we're doing a horror movie, we're doing a slasher movie, we're going to commit to doing it, you know, as best we can. I mean, it's interesting to kind of look at this in the context of 13 years later in the following season, where instead of doing Urban Legends, they decide to do Scream. And we see how that works out.
Yeah, we will. I'm dreading that one. But no, okay. But yes, now normally we go into the mailbag. There is only one, so I'll just go straight into it now. It's Brian Decker. He's said that I had a book of old scary urban legends, so I found this episode to be fun. Also remembered thinking it may have been easy to get in and out of the hospital undetected at night. Melinda McGraw gave a great performance as the lead psychologist. So that was the only comment that we made there. One thing about Melinda McGraw, actually, with this episode, is the one thing I did appreciate was her scream, because it wasn't over the top. It was actually quite grounded. I don't know if you picked that up, but I actually really enjoyed that bit.
I don't remember her scream. I'll have to go back and watch it again.
But yeah, have you got anything else before we close up for this week?
I just, again, kind of wondering if I'm reading too much into it, but the fascination with urban legends and the internet and it feeling like it's kind of developing the themes of the Mikado in that way.
Would have been interesting if Creepypasta would have been around this time, I think. I mean, I know X-Files touched on it, but...
Well, I was going to say, you could argue that, like, again, its spiritual companion is something, like, familiar in the kind of, like, final season of the X-Files, or final so far season of the X-Files, where you have this sense of kind of creepypasta kind of creeping in, and this idea that the internet has made all of this kind of local, all these local kind of legends more accessible. And it is, we mentioned it feeling like two different episodes stitched together, and I really do feel like the Urban Myths episode got the short shrift in that combination. I feel like, you know, the Nature of Evil episode is meaty, and it's in telling that we had the most kind of interesting fun discussing that. But I really kind of wonder if there was maybe a better version of the Urban Legend episode that it kind of opens with.
Right, okay, so it is time to call it a day. Next week we're talking Owls and Roosters, which will be great fun. So that's, I'm looking really forward to that. So continue on with our season 2 journey. But until next time, where can people find Adam online?
You can find me on Twitter, Adam_Chamberlain, just spell LN at the end because my name's too long. You can also still find the Back to Frank Black book at places such as Amazon, or you can go to fourthhorsemanpress.com and find out details about that. Incidentally, all sales from that book still go to the nominated charity, Children of the Night. The other thing I'd like to give a shout out for, so I have a blog that's kind of neglected, I don't write nearly as much as I should, called Frame of Mind, that's all about representations of mental health issues on screen, because I have a sort of personal and sort of creative interest in that, and I did write about the Pest House on there some time ago, probably several years ago now, but so if you go to screenwritingframeofmind.com, that blog is out there as well.
Fantastic, that'll be something I'll have a look at. Thank you for bringing our attention to that. It's brilliant. Darren, and where can we find you online?
Well, first of all, just to kind of second that recommendation for Back to Frank Black, it's an amazing book. I imagine a lot of people listening to the podcast have checked it out already, but if you haven't, if you're watching Millennium for the first time, it's an invaluable resource. It's really, really great. It's one of the best companion books I've ever read on a TV series. So I would recommend that for people. You can find me online at Twitter at Darren_Mooney. I co-host another podcast, as you mentioned, called The 250 with my good friend Andrew Quinn. We are adapting very interestingly to the kind of COVID-19 situation. We normally invite guests on, have them over for breakfast and talk about a film. Now we're going to see how that works when we do it remotely. So you can check us out and see how that's going for us as we're going along. I also write an Escapist magazine online where you can find me. I call them there twice a week. Just generally about on the internet. Just give me a quick Google and I'll probably turn up.
Fantastic. Well, you can find me at rmuldrake on Twitter. That's rmuldrake. We're also just about to wrap up. It would have finished just by the time this airs, but the Make It So Star Trek Picard podcast, which myself and Tony have been hosting, and we'll by the time
got
this...
some great guests.
Well, I've heard that the series finale had a fantastic guest, Darren.
All right.
And yeah,
let's
and
check
it
that
was
out.
That ending was amazing. The the Star Trek Picard ending, which hasn't aired.
Careful
yet.
Now.
but yes, Darren's coming to appear on the end of Make It So for us. And by then, we don't even know what's happening, but we are continuing the Star Trek. In the podcast as well, so we will be no doubt be putting out episodes around this time. It's something to do with the Star Trek universe as well, so that'd be great. So you can find that on at Jean-Luc Podard, which is where you can find me. I've also been a couple of times recently on the X-Files X-Cast, which I know that obviously Darren, you yourself has been on there recently as well. So the X-Cast is the X_cast. That's the best place to find us. And finally, we are part of the We Made This Podcast Network, and coming up is a little brief glimpse of what's been happening on the network. So thank you all for coming. Thank you both for coming on and talking with me about the Pest House. But until next time, this is who we are.
Previously on the We Made This Network. The giddy carousel of pop.
Carol Decker from T'Pau, who were actually at number one with China in Your Hand when this issue of Smash Hits was Indian news agents.
Carol's really up for it. She knows what the kids want. They want stories about being sick in a cowboy boot, so they get that. I've fallen asleep with my head down the toilet many a time, and Ronnie, who's out of the band, her boyfriend, has helped me throw up into a bucket.
She's a short-tempered bitch, according to what it says here in the article.
Didn't she throw some stuff at him?
Yes.
Life's milestones.
So let's move on and talk about birth. When and where and how were you born?
Through the vagina, I believe.
Oh. I've literally just said what a great man you are, and you're really crude. You are a very literal person.
I was born at the outset of the National Health Service in 1947.
Free with this month's issue.
When we supported them, we brought loads of like family and friends and people. My parents and my sister came, and as everybody was walking along the drive to get up there, their tour bus was there, and their guitarist was standing in the doorway beckoning at lots of underage girls while wearing a t-shirt that said drugs, unsuccessfully, and I think in a joking way that he was sort of beckoning. Okay. But
would have got me.
Yeah, my mum was not very impressed. Neither was my girlfriend at the time, Kelly, because I wouldn't let her go on the fucking tour.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced by Tony Black and Kurt North. We can be found on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod or by searching Facebook for The Time Is Now. We are part of the We Made This podcast network, which can be found on Twitter at We Made This Pod or on the website WeMadeThisPod.com. For bonus material and exclusives, check out our sister show, The X-Cast, and X-Files podcast, where you can find our Patreon. This is who we are.